It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Bottled water is supposed to be a temporary fix in a water quality emergency. But researchers find that women and recipients of federal food assistance are target markets for bottled water consumption. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Manny Teodoro is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. New research out on the relationships between bottled water, income, and gender. Manny, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be with you.
Your report findings of relationships between gender and income and how a person consumes bottled water, what is emerging? What are you finding?
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, bottled water consumption generally has been growing steadily in the United States over the last 25 years. But somewhat counterintuitively, bottled water consumption is inversely correlated with income. In other words, as people's income grows, their likelihood of drinking bottled water actually declines, which is surprising because bottled water is expensive. So bottled water consumption ends up being the highest among lowest income Americans. Even though on a unit cost basis, your water from your tap costs about a penny a gallon, water from bottles that you buy at a big box store costs something like $2 to $3 a gallon. So it's this ironically very expensive product that lower income people tend to buy. That's been well known now, really, for the last 10 years, as researchers over and over again have found that correlation. The thing that's new here that's surprising is that that correlation seems to appear only for women, or largely for women, and not for men. We've got a raft of new consumer behavior surveys and data from the last 3 or 4 years that show a very steep correlation between income and bottled water consumption, or rather negative slope, declining likelihood for women, but virtually none at all for men. So it appears that this relationship between income and bottled water consumption is distinctly gendered.
And why might women and men perceive tap water safety quite differently?
Yeah, we don't really know. Decades of research on risk perception generally show that women tend to be much more risk averse than men on a whole wide variety of things, whether, you know, whether you're talking about something like recreational sports to health and safety kinds of questions. Women just tend to be more risk averse. Men are more risk tolerant. We know that one of the main reasons people drink bottled water is the perception that it's safer than what comes out of the tap. And so the best thing that we can guess here is that women perceive bottled water as safer than tap water, and they're more sensitive to that perception, particularly at lower incomes. What we think might be going on here is that as income increases, of course, income is also correlated with education, and that maybe women who have higher levels of education understand more clearly the relationships between risk of bottled water and risk of tap water. And in general, for most of us, you know, tap water is just as safe, if not safer, than what comes out of a bottle.
I just want to pause here to acknowledge that communities that are poor, communities of color, you find are more likely to have drinking water problems, water utility problems. So how is bottled water connected to systemic racism and discrimination?
Yeah, no, that's an important point. There, some of my past research has shown that in cases, of course, we know about the high profile cases like Flint, Michigan, or Jackson, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. There are places where tap water failures are more likely to occur in places with very high non-white, very high poverty populations. And what we find is that those failures cause distrust generally across the country. So you might live in a community where the tap water is excellent, but if you're a member of a minority population or maybe part of a low-income group, part of what you perceive is that, hey, you know, a failure somewhere else for people who look like me, with whom I can identify, caused me to be less trustful of my, or more distrustful of my own tap water. And unfortunately, the way that that ends up playing out is people with relatively low incomes end up spending a lot of money on bottled water. It's a phenomenon that economists call defensive spending. They believe that they're defending themselves from a health risk, whether or not that health risk actually exists.
Now, you also take a look at SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, finding that women on SNAP are more likely to drink bottled water than men using the program. What does this tell you about the trust in tap water among low-income women and how these benefits are being used?
Yeah, well, you know, it's just in some ways an extension of the thing I talked about a moment ago, which is that, you know, people who are on SNAP, which is, for those of you who remember out there, it's the old food stamps program, but now it's been renamed, rebranded SNAP. It's a food assistance program for low-income people. And what we see is that the women on SNAP are much, much more likely than men on SNAP to spend those SNAP benefits on bottled water. More than 50%, according to our data, more than 50% of women on SNAP drink primarily bottled water at home. So they're spending a great deal of resources on bottled water. One of the things that's striking about that is that bottled water is a SNAP eligible purchase. In other words, if you receive SNAP benefits, you can use those benefits to buy bottled water. Now, I'm in no way suggesting that that's bad. I think it's good to let people use those SNAP benefits to buy legitimate things, but it adds up. You know, a conservative estimate is that somewhere between $1 and $2 billion of federal funding every year through the SNAP program end up going to bottled water. So we're talking about a significant amount of money. Just to put things in perspective, the water bill assistance program that ran during the COVID pandemic from the federal government spent about $600 million, or maybe close to $1 billion by that time it's all done, over a two-year period. Well, 1 year of SNAP spending will probably more than double that on bottled water. So we have a federal water assistance program, but it's only going to bottled water.
Manny Teodoro, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, studying bottled water consumption, trust in public water works. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers describe bottled water as lightly regulated and exponentially more expensive than tap water. We learn how bottled water consumption affects women and people living in poverty and hear from you. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Manny Teodoro is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, studies the bottled water industry and water equity. Manny, when you are looking to try to get to reliable, safe water, enter toxic chemicals, PFAS, and contamination there. You have said that filtering through point-of-entry technology may be a sustainable answer. What sets this filtering technology apart from other forms of management of these forever chemical in our water systems?
Yeah, point of entry technology, sometimes called point of entry treatment, is a promising thing, largely because of the what we're discovering about the distribution of risk of PFAS. I should start by saying this is an area of emerging research, so we're learning more about this stuff every day. But the more we study, the more it appears that the serious PFAS contamination is very intense, but very isolated. So it tends to be in smaller communities, smaller systems. you know, of course, in Wisconsin, we have a lot of smaller communities. And in Wisconsin, we have a lot of private well owners, a lot of people who rely on private wells. That's the kinds of places where we're finding the PFAS contamination is the worst. Well, it's very expensive to run a large-scale PFAS treatment for an entire, say, for an entire city, in order to treat a very small, isolated contamination site. So, point of entry treatment is a technology that treats or removes the PFAS contamination at the point where the water supply enters a home or enters a building. So the idea is that rather than treating an entire water supply that's used for everything from irrigation to firefighting, you just treat the water as it enters a home through filtration at the point where it enters the home. The technology seems to work pretty well in technical trials, but the challenge is maintenance, because a saturated and expired filter is actually worse than no filter at all. So the challenge is maintenance. And there's some interesting testing going on right now to see how that might work.
And with point of entry, like how far up the chain in the water process would the filtration system be?
The idea here is that we would treat for most of the conventional kinds of contaminants the way we always have at a treatment plant for microbial contamination or everything else. But the PFAS filtration would happen at the point where the water supply enters the home. That's why we've got the name point of entry treatment. So you've got a service line that connects your home or your building to the water main on the street. We would installing a filter at the point where that water supply enters the home. The real promise here would be if we can develop ways for that point of entry to be completely accessible from the outside, so that maintenance workers can reach the point of entry filtration from the outside and handle maintenance and monitoring from that spot without a homeowner ever, you know, without that person ever having to enter the home and disturb the homeowner.
Would that system have to be replicated for every housing unit?
Potentially, yes, in places where there's severe contamination. That's the idea. Now, I want to go back to the thing that I mentioned earlier. This is a technology that really only makes sense in places where contamination is severe.
Okay.
So there's a case in Washington State in a community called Yakima that's adjacent to a military base where they've got severe PFAS contamination. And this is the technology that they're employing there. It's really only an appropriate technology for situations with very severe PFAS contamination. But we do have a handful of those places in Wisconsin. And so it's a technology that's worth exploring here.
We're talking with Manny Teodoro, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. You can join in the conversation. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi.
Hi. I have some concerns about what I'm hearing about PFAS in particular. Those POET systems, the point of entry filtration systems, we have to remember that those filters become hazardous waste. If they contain the PFAS after the filters have been filled, we need a way to destroy them or store them so they don't go in a landfill and become part of contaminating more land with PFAS. And the other thing I think is really important to understand is the PFAS is leaking into the Bay of Green Bay through places like Marinette and Peshtigo from the northern part of the state. And the Bay of Green Bay is part of the Lake Michigan, which is part of the Great Lakes. And that's 90% of the fresh water in the United States. It is not a small problem.
Jane, thank you. Manny, your thoughts?
Yes, I want to start by saying Jane is absolutely right on the disposal question with filtration. It's one of the real challenges with point of entry treatment because, as I said earlier, it's maintenance and implementation, maintenance of this technology. When you've got a filter that's saturated with PFAS, what you're doing is, in fact, you know, as Jane suggested, you're kind of holding a bundle of hazardous waste. Yeah, you can't just stick it in the trash can, which is why you need to have professional maintenance, professional professional servicing of these units in order to dispose of that filtration media properly. For folks who aren't familiar with PFAS, disposal is one of the most serious challenges. These are chemical compounds that were designed to be difficult to destroy. And in fact, they are difficult to destroy. So yeah, she's absolutely right. As far as the scale of the issue with respect to the Great Lakes, I don't really have much to say. I don't really know that area of the issue. But yeah, this question of how to deal with filtration is one of the main challenges, maybe the main challenge with point of entry treatment.
I want to circle back for a moment to restoring trust in tap water. And in fact, we have less than a minute left. But is there anything policymakers can do to help build trust in the safety of tap water?
There's a lot of things that policymakers can do, and we could spend a whole other hour on it. But given the time we've got left, I'll say the single most important thing that we can do is have excellent tap water for everyone, everywhere. One of the surprising findings of some research I did with a couple of co-authors over the last few years is this idea that distrust of tap water is contagious. You could, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, you could be living in a community with excellent tap water, but if you see a failure down the road, across the country in a high profile case, you could come to distrust your own tap water. And so it's really ensuring that tap water is excellent for everyone all the time.
Manny, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a delight, Kate.
Manny Teodoro is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.